folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast was brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis, a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for the past 2 decades, 8 years of which he's been actively buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in the city on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So his company has a dedicated loan officer in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions. So you're probably already aware that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or if you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on emil.gorgis, that's emil.gorgis, emil.gorgis@tokyorealty.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. Okay, so for today's episode, this is a recording of a super deep conversation with a new potential client who's in the market for both his own family home and an investment property. And I'd say this is a really concise breakdown of almost everything that goes into property investment in Japan specifically. We start off by speaking about due diligence. So what sort of things a buyer should be looking at when they're trying to evaluate properties for both purposes, to live in versus to invest in, and that's a little bit different. We drill down further into the kind of due diligence required for investment condo units, how to correlate the reserve fund's total with the building's renovation history and the future renovation plans, things to look out for when you're investing in older buildings, potential buyouts by developers, the advantages and disadvantages of purchasing tenanted versus vacant properties, and what it actually means to buy a tenanted property sight unseen in Japan without an internal inspection, because this is always the case here. We also talk about tenant profiles, the average tenancy length, and also about our services and how we can help investors, how to choose investment locations based on investment portfolio allocations and the risk appetite, how to minimize your tax liabilities, what the purchase costs are for an investment property, how to calculate yields and profits, management fees, insurance coverage, tenant securities, guarantee companies and how they work, how much to put aside for future renovations, maintenance, vacancies, and also about resale strategies and whether it's possible to get your capital back if and when you sell. We also briefly touch on currency exchange, remitting money into and out of Japan, and how to use foreign exchange companies for this purpose. So a real deep dive this time, almost a mini webinar, if you will, touching almost every aspect of real estate property investment in Japan, at least as far as buying individual condo unit goes. So lay back, strap in, it's a pretty long ride, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Okay, so go for it. So you're thinking about both buying a family home and also about investments you've mentioned, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've been working in Japan for about eight years, and now I'm sort of saving money here. And I've been renting all that time, and I live in a nice area, and you know, I really, really like it. But then I was like, okay, well, maybe it's time to sort of invest some money. Also, I inherited some money. So I was like, okay, I could probably buy an apartment. So I started looking, trying to, you know, weigh up the sort of costs of and locations, and some are kind of a little bit below my budget, so that sort of left me a little bit left over. So then I thought, okay, maybe I can invest it in another property. And I've been listening to your podcast for the last sort of 3 or 4 months, sort of going back over the old ones and sort of getting a general idea of the sort of the market, etc. So I thought I'd reach out to you and sort of chat in more detail about things and sort of get your experience.
Sure. So the property that you're thinking to buy in Tokyo is an apartment for your own personal use, right?
Yes. Yeah, I think that was the just because I thought, well, I'm renting now. If I buy somewhere, then that would, you know, I'd save on rent, and then, you know, I'd have an asset. Okay, if I get fairly central, then it should retain its value. And if I decide to leave Japan or move somewhere else, then I could rent it out. That was the idea. So I'm sort of keeping it around the
area. You've mentioned money that you've saved and money that you've inherited. So you're not planning to buy it via mortgage financing?
No, I've only been eight years. My partner's not Japanese, so I can't go down that route.
What sort of visa are you on?
It's a humanity. Is it humanity? Yeah, humanities.
Okay, well, that...
I work in universities.
Is that renewable every few years, or is that...
Yeah. So it's pretty
busy. Are you on the track to permanency?
Well, I don't know what I assume... I looked at they got the scoring system, and I'm not quite young enough. My Japanese is okay, but not quite high enough. I don't quite earn enough. I'm not in the right sort of career. So all my points, it's just, you know, I'm never going to reach the 20 points that I need to get that.
I think after 10 years of residency, it's pretty much not guaranteed, but pretty much a smooth sailing to get it regardless of points, I think.
Oh, yeah, 10, but I've only been here 8 years.
Yep. Okay. So, no, just thinking, because if you would have waited, and even on the humanities visa, I think some of the banks that are more foreigner friendly, like Prestia, for example, even on that visa, they might consider you for a loan. It's just a shame not to get, because it's pretty much free money with the interest rates that are charging here.
Oh, yeah. No, I looked, I rang Prestia, and then they said, I think my basic wage is like a shade under 5 million. I mean, I do overtime and other jobs. So, yeah. But they were like, oh, no, it doesn't count. And I was like,
well, won't gonna... do, will it? Okay.
No, and I even said that I'm paying, like, you know, I could pay 50% or 60% deposit if need be. And they were like, no, it doesn't account. So,
okay, that's a shame. All right. So that was down that track. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's another one I can't remember. There's Prestia, and what's your, there's another one, Shinsei.
Shinsei is also pretty foreigner friendly.
Yeah, and I thought that, they were looking for, like, there's always a sort of, you know, partner Japanese. That sort of caveat seems to be in there, and I was even thinking, I've been with like Mitsubishi Bank for like 8 years, you know. Being a good customer, I thought, well, maybe even I could go and speak to them. But I need to do it in Japanese. So I was just trying to pluck up the Japanese skills to do that.
Okay. And you don't have a friend or a colleague who could come in with you? And
I could do. I mean, my Japanese, my teacher could come in with me.
But they're just worth pursuing. But okay. So let's put that aside for now.
Yeah.
So with the Central Tokyo property, as you've mentioned, you've been in touch with one real estate agency, and they've been, have they been showing you any potential properties, or are you just initial discussions, or what have you done with them?
Yeah, I've seen a couple of properties. I mean, I think it's the Tokyo real estate is that, obviously because I want fairly central and my budget is limited to 30 million.
Yeah.
It's properties that are 1960s, early 70s. They're all nice inside, you know, new. But there's always, you know, something, you know, to be in that bracket. You know, even they're a bit old and people have been warning me off because of the earthquake.
Yeah, standards. 60s, it's not just the earthquake standard. 60s, 70s means that sooner rather than later, a developer is just going to swoop in and try to buy it and redevelop it under the owners. So you might not be holding it for that long, I think, if it's that old.
Well, one property I saw, that was the selling point that they were pushing down, was saying, well, look, you could live in it for a couple of years. And they showed me the plans for rebuilding the apartment. Sendai, which was, you know, great location. But I think they said that it was like 6 or 7 or maybe 10 years off was the plan, and they still hadn't agreed amongst the owners of the apartment.
But then you'd be getting a new property when they build a new one, right?
Yeah, and they said that basically the land in which the property's on is a little bit bigger. So actually they were going to add 2 apartments to it. So there was a potential that you'd, you know, make money on it. But, you know, that was one of the first I saw, and I thought, wow. And the other problem was it didn't have a management company running the building. It was just
self-managed, is it?
Yeah, it was just the Oji-san in the building.
That can be a bit of a headache.
Yes, that was, people were just like,
You want professionals who know what they're doing to actually take care of renovations and repairs. And they also can help owners reach decisions a lot quicker. If it's self-managed, there's always a lot of bickering and arguing.
Yeah. Yes, that was one another. And then there was another one I saw, was again, really central location. And the buildings look good. And obviously they've been cared for, but there was no reserve fund. You know, they said,
have they done any big renovations in the last 10 years?
I think they had, but they just said, oh, there's no reserve fund. And I was like, oh, okay. So,
but that's not necessarily a red flag. So what we normally like to see is if the reserve fund is depleted, we want to make sure that in the last 10 years, the big ticket items were done. So the exterior, the roof, maybe the elevators, if you're lucky. And if that's been done in the last 10 years, then it does make sense that the reserve fund is depleted, but there's not going to be any huge expenses in the immediate range of time post-purchase. And nothing was done in the last 10 years, that's a bit of a red flag.
Yeah, I think there was no reserve fund because no one was paying any money for it.
Okay, so they weren't collecting very well, were they?
No, they weren't collecting at all. Okay. It just wasn't part of the... I think they said that, that I said, oh, so if there's any repairs need doing, oh, they just...
charge a one-off, yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, okay, so I could get here. I mean, there was no elevator in the building. It was only like 4 floors, 5 floors. So that. And it looked, you know, it looked like they kept it well. But I was like, oh, you know, these are all, you know, I'm quite happy to go through the process and just learn, okay, no, yeah, okay, I can see that. And, you know, if it takes me a few months or whatever, fine. But in the process, I'll learn about the market and I'll understand, you know, when I see the right property, it'll be like, yeah, boom, okay, I know what's out there, I know the prices, I know what's there.
Well, you seem to be ticking all the right boxes in your due diligence. So that's a good sign. You're learning.
Yeah, well, that's it. I don't want to, you know, it was my granddad's money. My granddad worked for like, 70 years of his life, a builder, and that saved all his money. And I think, I couldn't just spend it that easily. I've got to invest it in something adds value to my life. And, you know,
old school, was he? Just save under the mattress. Kind of my dad.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the thing, yeah. But I think in the days you used to get like, because I remember used to speaking to him sort of the last few years of his life, and he was moaning about the interest rates going down. And before, when he was saving, it was 5, 6, 7%. So, you know, he was happy with that. And then
it was a bit easier to save when the cost of living was a little bit lower in the past decades, right? It's not as easy.
So I think he, you know.
Okay, well, so for your Tokyo home, obviously that's something that you want to be, you know, visiting a lot of properties in person and looking at the exterior and the interior, because that's where you're going to be living. So for that purpose, I think the best thing for me to do would be to put you in touch maybe with a couple more real estate companies in Tokyo that are quite foreigner friendly, and they got English speakers on staff and they can help. So similar to the one you've been working with.
Yeah.
So when we're done, I'll send a couple of introductory emails to put you in touch with Tokyo agents. And with the investment property, so what's, assuming that you're purchasing the Tokyo property in cash, what sort of budget would you have left over for investment?
Well, I'm seeing one today, and it's like 24 million. I think it's 1982. So I was trying to push the real estate agent on, you know, whether it was sort of the side of the, you know, whether it had the new earthquake standards.
82 would have the new if the building plan was approved by June 1981. That would be up to the latest earthquake. Oh, you might be borderline there, depending on how long it took them to build it. Yeah.
I think it's just suspiciously low price for, it's like Meguro Shibuya border.
Yeah.
So Shinsen, which is like quite a des res area.
That might not only be because of the earthquake resistant standards. It might also be because they've been umming and ahhing about a new legislation that's supposedly going to, it was originally supposed to come in next year, but now they're sort of saying that they're thinking about when it's going to come in, but sooner or later it will happen. And what's that's going to do is it's going to put more of an onus on the owner unions to better maintain the buildings via some government standards that they're going to detail and lay out. And then what's going to happen, that's going to apply for buildings that are 40 years and older. And what's probably, we're assuming, is going to happen, there's going to be a compliance system and a certificate for buildings that either live up to the standard or don't. So what it's going to do is either the owner unions will be scrambling to catch up on the stuff that they haven't done, you know, too properly so far, which means that they'll have to jack up building fees to cover for that. Or they might choose not to comply, not to get the certificate, in which case there's suddenly going to be a market of certified and non-certified properties, and the price will probably reflect that. So what we've been seeing in the last couple of years is properties that are getting to the 35, 36, 37 age mark are suddenly being discounted quite significantly. So for investment, at least, we've been advising to our customers, until that legislation becomes a bit clearer, we've been advising them to maybe stick to properties that are 30 years and older.
So what's the date on that, like 1990s?
1991 or two at the moment. But that's for investment purposes. I mean, if you're talking about owner-occupied properties, you're paying a certain, you know, monthly amount for building fees. So as long as you are comfortable with it, potentially, I don't know, like worst case being doubled, let's say. As long as you're comfortable paying whatever that's going to end up being, if it's doubled, it shouldn't make such a huge difference. I mean, 82 for an owner occupier is not necessarily a horrible scenario to be in. For investment property, if building fees are doubled, it can pretty much reduce your yield by 2 or 3%. And that's a lot less attractive of a proposition, and it will also reduce this resale price. But for owner-occupied properties, not necessarily such a huge deal.
Right. Okay, so the new law basically sort of forced older buildings to comply to that, like what you said, which means they have to put in new...
A new standard, yes. It's not exactly a law, like they're not going to force them to do it, but they will need to do it if they want to be certified as a well-managed, compliant building kind of thing.
All right, okay.
Like a new certificate system, they're not going to force them to get it, but if they don't get it, that's obviously going to affect the price, I would assume.
So the well-managed is what, in what sense? Related to safety and things like that of the building?
First of all, they want to see regular owner union meetings, because a lot of them haven't been doing that. They might have appointed somebody who's died and they've never replaced him, that sort of thing. And what results from that is that there's not really building inspections being conducted on a regular basis. Some of them become an eyesore. Some of them are just outright dangerous because they're not being maintained.
Right.
So whatever the standard is that they're going to be putting out, I'm guessing it's going to be a bit more strict than what most, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of the owner unions have been doing so far. Some of them, like if you look at the renovation history and the inspection, you know, the periodic inspections and the renovation plans, if there's a clear renovation plan in place for the next, say, 5 years, and there's a clear renovation history for the last 5 or 10 years, then that building is probably already being well managed. But some of them just don't have that, right? Some of them are saying, oh, we don't have any immediate plans for renovation. And then you look at the past and you see that they haven't done the exterior for the last 10 or 15 years. And then you, well, hang on, why don't you have a renovation plan in place? Because obviously every 15 years at most, some of those, the roof, the exterior, some of these items need to be done. The elevators need to be done every 20, 25 years if there is an elevator. So either the last 10 years or the next projected 5 years, there should be something that says there's going to be a big renovation happening or has happened. And if that's not clearly defined in documents from the owner union, then that is probably what the government wants to address. So these types of buildings that are not doing it properly or regularly enough.
So what red flags do I need to look for? Just look for the renovation history.
10 years renovation history. You want to see that the exterior and the roof at least have been done in the last 10 years. And if they haven't been done, if one of them hasn't been done, you want to see that, like if you take the total amount in the reserve fund pool and then you divide it by the number of units in the building, that gives you a certain amount per unit. So you want to see that, I'd say, depending on how many big renovations were done in the last 10 years, if nothing was done, you want to see maybe a third of the value of each unit covered by the reserve funds. If one of the big ticket items was done, maybe half of that, so let's say 15, 18% covered. And if it's not, then they're probably going to be jacking up building fees or they're going to be taking out a loan when they need to do that.
Right.
In which case, if they take out a loan, they would also be jacking up the building fees, or if they've got collection issues, they might just, like the self-managed ones, they might just ask each owner to pay out, say, suddenly a million or million and a half yen. Which again, it might not be a disaster from your perspective as an owner-occupier. So maybe you can put up with that expense or you can put up with double the building fees, but just something to take into account. If it's an investment property and it's suffering from the same sort of lack of reserve funds and lack of recent renovations, then you want to factor in that. I mean, again, run the Excel sheet. I'll send you a sample of how to do that and then double the building fees and see if the return is still going to be attractive or not.
Right. Okay. So to look at the reserve fund and the renovation history. So if
the 10 years, and then also look if they have a renovation plan for say the next 5 years.
Okay.
I mean, some of them will be aware that they haven't done big renovations in the last 10 years, and therefore they will put a plan in place. So that means that the building is being well managed from a renovation and repair perspective, but it's still a matter of whether they have enough funds or if they're going to have to jack up the fees for that.
Right. So if nothing big has been done, then you're saying they need a third of the value for each unit. That's quite a lot.
If nothing big has been done in the last 10 years, then, I mean, from our experience, let's assume a worst case scenario, like a big earthquake hits and the building gets completely total lost. In that case, they're going to use the reserve fund to clear out the rubble and then they're going to divide it between the owners, whatever's left. So there's going to be some compensation there. Your insurance policy will cover you up to, say, 50 or 60% of the value. So the remainder, we'd like to see 30% for big major work that might need to get done.
Is that typical? Do you find that?
We haven't had a case where anything like that happened, but thinking about how much they're going to be spending, depending on the size of the buildings, the more units there are, obviously, the more renovations cost. So it's just a benchmark figure for us. We like to see at least that much covered. Like if nothing was done in the last 10 years, but the reserve fund pool divided between all the units does cover about 30% of the value of the properties, then we're feeling relatively comfortable that they will have enough funds to do the renovation when it's needed. And even if they do jack up building fees, it's not going to be a huge amount. They might, you know, go up from 5,000 to 7,000 or something of that sort. But yeah, if it's less than that, not necessarily a deal breaker, but maybe try to cover yourself by negotiating the price down a little bit.
Okay. Rented units. Okay. So that's, yeah. Interesting. Okay. Was there anything else? I've got a lot of questions here.
No, no, go for it.
Okay. I'm just trying to think about, I've been, obviously a lot of foreign investors are coming in. So who are typically selling these properties the around Japan or in, because they're obviously not new builds or old builds. Who's typically sort of selling them on?
Most
companies or?
Yeah, Japanese. So we've been mainly purchasing from elderly Japanese folks.
Ah, okay.
who are either restructuring their portfolio or they're reaching the point where they're asking their kids if they want their properties inherited when they pass away. And most of the kids are just not really aware of the value of that. So they just say, sell them and give us cash instead. And the other, I'd say 30, 40%, so 60% would be those, and 30, 40% are just real estate companies or investment companies that do this for a living. So they buy properties, they buy and hold them, or they buy and renovate and flip them and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Younger generation sellers, not so many. Foreigner sellers, occasionally we get a foreign seller, but not that many of them.
Yeah, because a few of the ones I've been seeing this seem to be owned by companies that sell these old properties, do them up, and then, like you say, flip them.
Yeah. It's not a bad thing as long as the return is still attractive. Why not?
Okay, yeah. So it doesn't. And then, so typically, so you say wouldn't touch things before 81. They'll sort of make sure they've got the. Although you said 92 now, you're because of the.
Well, for investment properties, for if you're talking about a property for yourself to live in, then maybe as long as it's past the 81. Building standard, it's probably okay. But still, I mean, the fact that a developer might come in and buy the building is not always, I mean, some of them try to sell that as an attractive point. It's not always that attractive. And because obviously they're going to be trying to pay as little as possible. And if the building is large, it's not going to be worth their while to compensate each and every unit owner at a relatively high amount. So they got all sort of gray area, semi-dodgy tactics. Like they might buy two or three or four units at a reasonable price so they can get a vote on the owner union. And then they got three or four votes and they try to influence whoever's heading the union sometimes. Kind of not outright bribe, but just being really nice to him and giving him presents and that sort of thing. So that the owner union then, the head of the owner union then tries to pressure unit owners to agree to the sell plan. And they do that by telling them that the building's really old and pretty much done with its lifespan, and very soon you're going to be looking at a lot of a lot of expenses, and you just want to sell it as fast as you can for whatever. And they don't necessarily offer you good value for it. They're not outright illegal, but they're not really. Not all of them are very fair to and. Most of the people who own units in these buildings are not very savvy, especially owners, occupiers. They're not investors. They haven't bought a bunch of units or a bunch of properties in their lifetimes. So they're sort of easily influenceable by these sort of tactics. And once they get an 80% agreement, they just sell it at whatever price they agreed on. So if possible, I would stick to 90, at least 1985 and younger if you can. Just to give you, 10 years or what before this starts happening, right?
Right. So the average age of, because I was trying to research that, the average, because it's obviously post-war Japan built lots of houses and the quality wasn't so good. So there was, I didn't know whether it was to do with that okay, they don't last so long because, the post-war building were not that great, or that was the typical standard.
Well, that's houses, though. That's wooden structures. You're talking about reinforced concrete. Yeah.
Ah, so it's wooden.
The reinforced concrete blocks are built very well. They're built to withstand earthquakes. Even before the 1981, even if they were built before that, there's a lot of stuff that they can do to further strengthen it. Not quite bring it up to post-1981 standards, but still, they're quite reliable and strong. I mean, with the amount of earthquakes that Japan takes every year, you would expect it to be a total disaster if they weren't built. I mean, it would be rubble all over the place, and that's not really the case. So it's not a huge disaster if it's built pre-1981. We're more considering it because of the potential to be bought out cheaply at a later stage.
You wouldn't have any, so just someone would just come in and say, we want your building and sort of, and then you, because
the
of
process, the process, it takes them a few years, but they've got time on their hands. If it's a prime location in Tokyo, they're very happy to put in the 4 or 5 years that it'll take them to convince enough people to sell.
Right. Okay. And then that wouldn't be good for the owner. They wouldn't sort of like, okay, well, I can get a a good return on this?
Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. If the building, again, is well managed and the owner union and there's a, you know, a good, strong building management company in place, then they would be acting on the best interest of the unit owners. But sometimes that's not the case. So basically, the smaller the building is and the larger the land parcel is, the more attractive it is to developers, in which case they'll probably offer a fair price or a new property when it's being rebuilt. But if you're looking at, for example, those big concrete monsters that are, say, 100 units or 200 units, and they're pretty much filling up the space that they're allowed to fill, the building ratio on the land parcel, that's when developers will try to get as much value for their money as they can, because compensating, you know, 100 unit owners at a relatively high price and then building a building that's not going to be much larger than the original, there's not much profit in it for them unless they can push the price down.
Right. Okay. That wouldn't be a tactic to pursue buying something to slightly older. And
I wouldn't bank on it unless, again, it's a small building that's relatively easy on a relatively large land parcel.
Right. Yeah.
Like, basically, if a developer can build something bigger on that same land parcel once they demolish the old building, and that might be a good strategy to pursue. But if it's going to be something similar to what's already on there, then I wouldn't bank on that being profitable.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because the sort of real estate agent was pushing that as a strategy, saying, "I'll do this, do that." I was kind of okay, but. You know, still thinking about it. And
it depends on the developer too. Like, if they've already got a particular developer in mind and they've already been discussing a sale plan, then they might have a price in mind as well. So it's something that you can actually review and look at. Right. But otherwise, if it's an unknown, it depends on, you know, who's going to be making the offers and, you know, whether they're nice guys or not, really.
Okay, second.
Point is, it's not going to be, you get a vote, but it's not going to be your decision to make. You're not going to be able to reject an offer. I mean, you can potentially refuse to sell, but then you'll be stuck, you know, as the sole, you and a few other stubborn people will have units in the building and the new owner wants to demolish it and they'll slowly start making life more difficult for you. They might decide to stop water supply or gas supply. They'd be within their rights to do it. I mean, you control the space inside the interior of your unit, but they're under no obligation. If they own the common areas of the building, then they can pretty much do whatever they want with the infrastructure, right?
Oh, crikey. Okay, sounds... Yeah. Okay, yeah, I mean, it's not...
Maybe not to scare you off, but I'm just saying don't bank on it as a strategy that you might get bought out at a profit. It might happen, but it's not something to bank on.
Yeah, no, it was only just that the particular real estate was pushing that as the strategy to buy that place. So maybe because they were getting desperate to sell it or...
But maybe there's a plan already in place. Maybe who's going to be buying it and for how much. So in that case, it is a strategy.
Yeah, I think they had, but I think it was the... what was it? They showed me all the plans and that, and they talked about the land being bigger and they were going to add two units. But I think they negotiated with the people living in the apartment, but I think only a couple had agreed. I think it was about 15 who lived in the apartment, and the rest were just like, "Oh, we'll wait and see," kind of thing. So yep. They would sort of say it's going to maybe 10 years down the line when the building gets so old.
Well, look, if there is a buyer already lined up who said that they will compensate all unit owners with a new property in the new building, that is a plan. But like you said, whether everybody will agree or they're just going to be waiting, and then whether that particular buyer will still be interested by the time everybody agrees is just anyone's guess, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I thought it better to... I mean, it was one of the first places I saw, so I thought there's no point jumping in straight away.
Yeah.
Okay, so what were the other... I was trying to go for like pre-buying and... I've got my questions. So I think you talked about yesterday, I listened to it yesterday, but it was a couple of days ago, that when you're buying a place, if it's tenanted, you can't access the build. You can't access to look at what it's
the interior.
Like.
Yep, correct.
Yeah. So how does that, you know, so if I'm buying an apartment, and you know, it's, even if it's 1990, someone's been living in there 10 years. Obviously, does that affect the value? I mean, is that is that sort of risk?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's a pro and a con to that, right? So on the other hand, on the one hand, you're getting a stable tenant who's been there for a long time and is, you know, in all likelihood going to stay another at least 5 or 10 years. The downside to that is that, you know, if and when they do move out, or if they're elderly and if they, you know, check into a nursing home or pass away, then after a 10, 15, 20 year tenancy, you're going to be looking at a very substantial renovation bill. Which is, I mean, that's one of the reasons that, aside from the fact that they're cash cows, people also prefer the smaller units because, you know, there's a cap on how much they're going to have to spend to renovate a one bedroom or a one LDK unit, right?
Yeah.
And whereas if it's a family size property and you've had a family in there for 20 years, then, you know, whatever the renovation bill would have been for a studio, multiply that by 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
Just because of the size of the property. So by limiting yourself to smaller smaller layout units, you're minimizing the renovation cost. And you can sort of assume by the length of the tenancy and the character, the profile of the tenant, you can sort of assume what the renovation cost would be, right? You know, women, especially middle-aged women, tend to take better care of a property than, sorry to say, dirty old G-sons. So depending on who the tenant is and how long they've been living there, you can sort of roughly estimate what's going to be the cost if and when they move out. And you can try to use that as a negotiation technique to slightly reduce your offer price. But to a point, I mean, depending on the location and, you know, what the yield of the property is at the moment, the seller will probably know how much they can get for it. So there's no really, I mean, lowballing is not really done much in Japan. Maybe 10%, 15% off if it's, you know, something extreme, but not more than that.
Okay, right. And then, okay, so that's factored in. So then you talked about doing due diligence. So who does that? I mean, I printed a list from the internet and I just sort of go through, oh, reserve fund, this, with my, so if I'm buying through you, you just put us in touch with an estate agent and then we talk to them, or?
That's totally up to you. So some customers engage us on a consultation basis, which means that, you know, you're going to be sending potential properties to us and we'll give you our opinion about them. We'll, you know, direct you what questions to ask and what sort of things to watch out for and what would be a reasonable price to offer and so forth. Others hire us for complete facilitation. So, I mean, either you do the research and provide us with potential, or we do it on your behalf. And then we'll be the ones contacting the agents on your behalf, doing the due diligence, letting you know what we think of everything, and facilitating the purchase itself. So you've mentioned that your Japanese skills are still not maybe completely up there.
Yeah, like N3 intermediate level.
Okay, so you're not going to be able, in any case, unless you're dealing with an agent that specializes in catering to foreigners, in which case they'll provide you with legal documents to sign in English. But that's a pretty limited market to deal with. And it's a lot more feasible in Tokyo and central Osaka, maybe. If you're looking at properties elsewhere, there's not always going to be an agent who's going to be able to do that. And also working with a single agent just limits your access to the market, right? Because listing agents don't like to share their commissions with buyer side agents. One of the advantages of working for us is that we're not a realtor, we're not an agency. So when we contact a listing agent, we immediately let them know that they don't need to share their commissions with us because the buyer is paying us separately and it's nothing to do with that. And B, they'll never have to speak to a scary foreigner or provide any English documentation because everything will be done through us, a Japanese company, Japanese reps and so forth. So that just opens the market up a little bit. So aside from the due diligence and the consultation and, you know, helping you out through the process, we can do either on an hourly basis or a full facilitation. We'll do that either way. But with the full facilitation, we'll also be the ones in touch with the agents. We'll be signing all the documentation on your behalf. And so it just opens up more access to the market. That's all.
Yeah. Okay.
When you're talking about investment properties, which area were you also thinking about Tokyo, or were you going?
Well, I assume that if I've got, so for example, if I get one for 24, then sort of leaves me like 5 million or something like that.
Oh, that's not going to be Tokyo anyway, is it?
Yeah. So that's I mean, you could do, but it wouldn't be a very decent investment.
Yeah, you would be able, for 5 million, you could potentially maybe get something in Yokohama or Saitama, maybe Kawasaki if we're lucky, if you want to stay close to Tokyo.
Right.
Otherwise, Nagoya, Kobe, even Fukuoka City still has some 5 million or less properties, I think. And it would definitely buy you properties in smaller prefectural capital satellite cities and so forth, where return could potentially be higher, but you'd have less potential growth, more likely to lose value if the economy goes south.
We interrupt this broadcast. I always wanted to say this. We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, or if you just need summer quiet to hide away from the world. So they offer a variety of options for families, for corporate relocations, or simply if you're transitioning between homes in Tokyo. Now, the properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really, the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They've got fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens, and they're just a delight to stay in, a fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but long-term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profits, or a holiday home that you want rented out when not in use via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth your visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at emil.gorgies, G-O-R-G-E-E-S, at tokyorealty.jp.
Right. So that was the second question. How do you decide on the location then? Because in your presentation, you talked about this sort of Fukuoka, Yokohama,
Kobe,
and then prefectural. You sort of had maybe like a ranking, wasn't it?
Almost. No, it wasn't. It was just particular order. I just listed attractive locations there. We basically look for, like I mentioned in the presentation and the conference, we basically look for stable population figures.
Yeah.
They don't have to be growing, but they shouldn't be declining too fast. And we look at industries and employers, like just to make sure that we've got a sufficient tenant base at any given point in time. So blue collar is maybe okay, but we don't want to have a single employer. You know, if they pack up and move to another city, then everybody needs to, you know, the town, like a mining town, it just clears up. Yeah. So we want to see at least two or three industries and quite a few big employers, or maybe a bunch of small employers. But anyway, not a one trick pony kind of town.
And how do investors usually decide what's the, based on the yield, or they have, you know, you push them in certain.
Yeah, so beyond that, it depends on the investor. If this is, in your case, for example, because this is going to be, I forgot to ask, by the way, are you invested overseas in anything else? Do you have any sort of stock portfolios or other real estate or anything like that?
I've got my pension in the UK, and then ETF, Vanguard ETF.
Okay.
Yeah, so a bit of stocks, so sort of, yeah.
Okay. And is this let's say this 5 million yen, is that going to be in relation to the rest of your portfolio? Is that like half of it, 30% of it, more than half of it? What is it going to be? I'm just trying to recommendation on the risk profile. That's all.
Yeah, I mean, not the. No, I haven't, because I originally had a pension fund, but it wasn't. I was paying too much fees on it, so I pulled out of that and then stuck the money into a low fee sort of Vanguard Global ETF.
Yeah,
and I've got maybe only about $50,000 in that. Okay. I started last year, and then UK pension fund. That's pretty. $1,000 a month goes into that.
So half roughly the property investment.
Yeah, I suppose, and then I've got like $300,000 US in cash, which, you know,
but that's not for investment. That you're gonna use that for your home, right?
Yeah, probably most of it, and then whatever's left over, I'll put into a smaller property if possible.
Okay, so let's call it approximately half of your investment portfolio in this case.
Yeah.
So in this case, I would probably recommend to be a bit more safe and stable, not go too adventurous chasing high yields if it's going to be half of your assets, or half of your investment assets, obviously not the place that you're going to be living in, but half of your investment, then maybe keep it a bit more safe and stable. So I would probably advocate for Kobe, Fukuoka, maybe suburban Osaka, if we can find something at that price, or central, or at least semi-central Yokohama, because Yokohama tends to be very suburban once you get away from the port area. So try to stay maybe within 3-4 stations from that area, if it's Yokohama. Definitely Kawasaki. I wouldn't go for satellite cities, prefectural capitals, and so forth, if that's going to be half of your investment portfolio. And I'm also going to try and avoid anywhere that's too blue collar in character. Just because, I mean, it's Japan, there's not going to be crime in ghettos, but still you might have occasional payment issues. Like if you're buying in Nagoya, for example, we've experienced more tenant and payment issues there than in other places, just due to the nature of the city. So yeah, I'd probably direct you towards Fukuoka, Kobe, Yokohama, Saitama maybe. Saitama's pretty good as well.
Right, just because they're sort of popular kind of places and relatively stable.
Yes, so the population there is not in decline. They're close enough to a big city. Fukuoka is a big city, but the rest of them are close enough to a big city to enjoy those dynamics. And also, like, for example, I could recommend Sapporo, which is also a relatively a white-collar city, and it's one of Japan's biggest cities, and the population is not in decline. But there you've got winter issues, right? So when it snows, people don't move around much. So if you happen to get a vacancy close to winter, it could be a pretty long one. There's a lot more heating equipment, so maintenance is slightly higher. So again, it's a good city to invest in, as are the satellite cities and the prefectural capitals, but maybe not for your first investment if it's going to be half of your assets.
Right. So you just want something that maybe slightly lower.
Lower yield. On the yield, but safer and stable, yeah. It will be easier for us to populate the property in this in those cities when it becomes vacant.
So 5 million. So how much would I invest 5 million in the property, and then what's the sort of fees on top of that, and then what's the yield?
So in those cities, the yield would probably not be beyond 6.5%, maybe 7% net before tax, if we're lucky. So that's net pre-tax. So depending on, I'm not sure. You've mentioned an annual salary of about 5 mil, so you must be paying something like 10 or 15% income tax, right?
I'm not sure, actually.
That's right.
Always seems relevant, but plus the local tax as well. I live in Shibuya, so.
Yeah. So I mean, your individual tax situation might just make sure. I mean, are you working with an accountant at all?
No, my company does all that.
Well, when you're buying an investment property, it's probably a good idea to get, I mean, post-purchase, it's probably a good idea to get an accountant on board. Because he's going to be able to advise you what to claim and how to claim to minimize your taxes. Because now you're going to have two income streams. You're going to have your salary and you're going to have the property income. So they can get a bit creative with that and try to minimize your taxes, carry off the expenses, the purchase expenses, management expenses, and so forth. So net pre-tax in those cities, if I get 7%, I'd be very happy. Usually it's going to be 6, 6.5. And cost-wise, if you're working directly with an agent, it's probably going to be, at this price level, probably going to be 15% worst-case purchase cost. 15%. And that's comprised of the agency fee, which is going to be 3% plus 60,000 plus tax. So for these price property, for 5 million property, it's probably going to be close to 4.5-5% agency fee. And then legal and registration would be somewhere between 2.5 to 7%, depending on the official evaluation of the property. And your purchase tax also varies depending on the official eval, but usually not more than 2.5%.
Right, correct. So it's quite a lot.
Yeah. So worst case, we like to assume 15% if you're working directly with an agent. If you're working through us, there's another 5% on top of that.
Okay. That's 5%.
Hopefully we'll be able to save you from costly mistakes and help you negotiate the price if possible. So I hope our customers like to think that we're more than worth it.
Okay, so 5 million, there would be potentially an extra million on top in fees.
Worst case scenario, 20%, yeah.
Okay.
Well, usually it's going to end up being something like 16, 17, but we assume worst case when we're evaluating deals so that it's not going to get, it's only going to get better by settlement.
Right, okay. And then so you buy the property and then the rental yield, how's that sort of calculated? How do they work out what the
listings that you see online, they've got two kinds of yields that they list, one that they call coupon yield and one that they call net yield. The coupon yield you can disregard completely, it's pretty meaningless, because they don't factor in anything aside from the property price and the rental income. The net yield is closer to net, but it's not really net as well, because they don't factor in purchase costs. They don't factor in property management. They only factor in the building fees. So I would say if you're working through us, maybe take off 3-4% of the yield that you see on listings. To get the real value. But in any case, if you do work with us, once we're starting to evaluate potential properties, we're not going to go off the listings. We're going to put them in an Excel sheet that breaks down the worst case purchase costs, the management costs, insurance, property management, our management, if you need our help with managing it as well. And the bottom yield that you're going to see in the Excel sheet is going to be net pre-tax worst case. At the time of purchase, obviously, as the building gets older, building fees might get higher, rent might drop. If we're lucky, Japan's economy might improve and rent might go up, but we haven't seen that happen to any significant degree yet. So obviously, throughout the investment life cycle, the yield might change. But at the time of purchase, what you see on the Excel sheet is going to be the worst case scenario.
So on a 5 million property, what would be this? So there would be the building would already, or the apartment would already be tenanted, or you'd buy somewhere untenanted.
Again, advantages and disadvantages to both. If you're buying tenanted, you're buying straight into income as opposed to into expenses. So it's pretty much turnkey, making income from day one. The upside of a vacant property is that it's going to be recently renovated, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're saving yourself the at least the first renovation fee that you'd be up for if and when your tenant moves out. And the best of both worlds is if we manage to get a property that's just recently been tenanted. So it's been renovated and it already has a tenant in place.
Okay. So then, what would be the So what would be the typical rent on that someone would pay, say for example, 5 million in Yokohama, how much would they be paying a month for?
Depending on location, they're probably going to be paying something like 40,000-45,000 yen. Okay. But that's not taking into account building fees and property management and so forth. So rather than look at what rent they're paying, it's better to look at what actual yield you're going to get in your pocket. So if we're assuming Yokohama on a 5 million property, let's say conservatively, let's say we're expecting, say, 4.5%, let's call it, right? Yield.
Okay.
Which means that every month you'll be getting approximately 20,000 yen.
That's after all the...
After all of the fees, yeah.
Okay.
And if we manage to get something that's better, then it might be 25,000 yen or 27,000 yen. But on a 4.5% kind of conservative estimate of 4.5% yield, that's probably going to be about 20,000 yen pocket.
Okay. And then... that includes ongoing fees, so it includes the reserve fund management fees.
Yep.
Then
property management fee is usually 5% plus tax, so 5.5% for the property manager who handles the tenants. They're the ones who collect the rental income and respond to maintenance requests and so forth, and they're the ones who are also going to help you find a tenant when it's vacant.
What about insurance?
They got a separate fee for that.
So insurance is...
Insurance is minute for these properties. It's $2-3 a month from memory, I think.
Yeah, I remember. I pay the fire fee here, I think. It's like 5,000.
Yeah, the tenant pays the fire insurance and the tenant insures their own body and possessions. And you insure the interior of the unit. So, you know, the walls, the windows, the fixtures, and so forth.
Right.
And most importantly, you insure against third-party damages. So, for example, if your hot boiler goes and you're leaking water into the unit below, that's going to be fully covered by your insurance.
So I just buy one-off insurance that would cover all that?
Yeah, renewable every 5 years. Doesn't cover everything. So... wear and tear damages to stuff in your apartment is not covered. So again, if we take that hot boiler example, the boiler goes, you still need to pay for a new boiler, right? Or for the repair, but you're not going to be paying for third party damages. But if there's an earthquake or a fire or a typhoon damages, then your insurance does cover you to a certain degree. So I think for fire, it's maybe close to 100%. For earthquakes, it's around 50-60%. And that also goes on the official eval of the property. So sometimes you're going to find that you're going to get a little bit more than 50, a little bit less than 50. It's not always going to be exactly as market price.
Right. And then...
you also want to get landlord insurance in case your tenant dies in the property. But that's, again, it's not too expensive. I think it's less than 5,000 yen a year or something like that.
So there'll be two, landlord insurance and then sort of earthquake and
they call it fire insurance, but it includes all damages.
Okay. And who would organize? I would organize that myself, or that would be done through
totally up to you. If you, as part of the settlement, if you take us on for full facilitation, we'll put that in place as part of the settlement process. And then ongoing management. So the insurance companies and the property managers that we would be working with would usually be normal Japanese companies, not too foreigner savvy. So if you do want to also manage your portfolio on your own after settlement, I'd probably direct you to work with insurance companies that would be able to communicate with you directly. And same goes for property managers. But if you're going to use us for management as well, then we will just put in place the best offers that we know.
So the fees to you, you said there was was it 5%?
So it's 5% on the purchase.
Yeah.
Plus tax, so 5.5. And there's a minimum cap, which is exactly your budget. So we don't charge less than 5% of 5 million yen. So the minimum is always going to be 275, including tax. So So even if you end up buying a property that's, you know, $4.5 million, it's still going to be that five million. And then that's a fixed amount. So we're not, even if you end up looking at, you know, submitting offers, conducting due diligence on, you know, 12 properties, we're not going to charge you anything extra for extra work. It covers you until settlement. And then for management, if you do need our help with management, we charge basically 2% of the rental income, but we also have a cap, minimum cap on that of 1 monthly hour at 2,800 yen plus tax. So roughly 3,000 yen per month.
3,000 yen per month. And that covers all the dealings with property.
All standard dealings with the property. If we have to, if there are insurance claims, court, you know, court claims, if we have to suddenly, you know, forcibly, no, that's not forced evictions in Japan, but if a tenant suddenly disappears and we have to get a court order to enter the unit to see if they're still there, those sort of that sort of unroutine work is charged on an hourly basis.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
But for standard, just to, you know, to manage the property manager and, you know, receive, make sure that the rent is being received and make sure the expenses are being paid and so forth, that's just 1 hour per month.
Okay.
So when a property becomes vacant, the property manager would be charging 1 month of the rental income when they place a new tenant. And we would be charging half a month.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah, because usually you pay the key money, which goes to the landlord, doesn't it?
Key money. I mean, there's vacant, which is like the thank you fee.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes we personally don't think it's a fair fee, and if at all possible, we instruct the property managers not to charge that.
Yeah.
But depending on the city, depending on the property manager, some of them is just the way they work, so we can't really change the industry.
Yeah.
And then key money is what you pay to actually change the key and the lock, right? To actually get a new key and lock. And that's real money that's being paid to the maintenance company to do that. The thank you fee, if it is being charged, usually goes to the landlord. There's a contract renewal fee when a lease is renewed, which depending on the existing, like if you're inheriting a property with a tenant in place, the previous landlord might have not charged them a contract renewal fee, in which case the owner will need to pay that when the contract is renewed.
Okay.
But it depends on whatever lease they've got in place there.
Yeah. Month's rent, isn't it? Just usually a month's rent.
Usually a month's rent, yeah.
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 Then the deposit. So how does that, so there's a tenant in there, do I inherit the deposit?
Yes. So if you're getting a tenanted property, it depends on what sort of securities they have. Some of them will have a shikikin, a security deposit, in which case that will be deducted from the purchase price. So you basically inherit it. But in some cases, and for example, when we place a new tenant, we'd actually rather get a guarantee company instead of a security deposit because they'll cover up to 3 months of rent, whereas the security deposit is usually 1 month. And they'll also cover cases, like, for example, in the case that I've mentioned where we have to, you know, a tenant disappears and we have to wait until we get a court order to take possession of the unit again. In that case, the guarantee company will cover the rent until we get the court order, which sometimes can take a year. Right. So we would much rather have a guarantee company if possible. But when you inherit a tenant, then you inherit whatever they've got. If they've got a security deposit, you got to live with that.
And then usually they have a guarantor, don't they? So they do.
Yeah, I wouldn't count on those for anything, though.
Right.
They're just people. Sometimes they got a guarantor who's their dad, and dad has already passed away since they signed the lease. Or it might be a brother who's just not going to, is going to say he doesn't want anything and apply to court to not have to pay. So personal guarantors are the worst possible security. I wouldn't count on them for anything. Sometimes you can get something off them, but not always. I mean, they're more reliable than they are in other countries because there is this saving face thing. Like, you know, if my brother is stuffed up, then I don't want to be, you know, the one to tarnish my reputation by not paying his debt. But they're still the weakest form of security.
Right. So you said to me you get a guarantor because I got my company to be the guarantor, but I know, you know, there was like, okay, well, the other option is a guarantor company.
A corporate If the personal guarantor is an employer, that's much better. That's something that you can actually depend on. But a guarantee right. company, what I mean by a guarantee company, it's kind of like rent insurance. It's something that the tenant signs up for. And then they're an added layer between the property manager and the tenant. So the tenant pays them and they pay the property manager every month. And if the tenant for any reason is late or missing on some payments, they will still be paying you every month. And then they'll work to retrieve that debt from the tenant directly. So you don't need to be involved in that. And if they run into issues for 3 months, they haven't received payment, then they'll let you know that, look, this tenant seems to not be paying. So we're going to terminate the lease on the tenant's behalf.
So you would negotiate that to be added in, or that's already...
For new tenants, if we're placing new tenants, we'll insist on that.
All right.
Because the other advantage of that is that the guarantee companies or the rent insurance companies, whatever you want to call them, they also do they don't approve tenants for this sort of service if they don't think the tenant will be paid. So it's sort of a credit check, which is the only way for us to get credit checks in Japan. There's not really an official credit check system like there is in other countries. So we would insist that new tenants have this in place. And if they're not approved for that, that's a red flag. We don't want to take that tenant. Unless, I mean, look, sometimes you'll get like a foreign student who just, you know, they don't qualify, they don't have anyone, they don't have an income history in Japan, they don't know anyone. And then we might, you know, I mean, we'll consult with you. It's always, you're the one making the final choice, but we might advise that this looks like it might be a safer to just take a security deposit. It's not a bad tenant. They just can't get it for various reasons, right? But if you inherit a tenant, then you inherit them with whatever they've got in place. They might have just paid a security deposit. In that case, we can sometimes ask them to sign up for rent insurance or for a guarantee company. But in that case, you'll have to pay the sign-up fee, which again is equal to approximately 1 month of rent. Like, we can't force a tenant to pay for that just because we took over a property, right?
Right, okay. So I suppose you just...
Very much case by case with that.
Yeah. So I'd say, okay, I've got this budget, and then you'd go away, search, you'd bring... Would you do all the kind of due diligence in the sense of looking at all that, and then yep. you'd arrange to me, and yep. I would discuss together.
That's what we do basically. So we research, we provide potentials, we tell you what we like more or less about each of the potentials, and then you help fine tune us or give us more focus. Like, for example, you point out that you don't like this or this or that, and then the next research round will fine tune it according to what you've mentioned. And then when we finally have, you know, one or two potentials that we'd like to pursue, we start contacting listing agents and submitting offers, asking for due diligence. Part of the due diligence is not going to be available until we submit an offer. For example, the building's renovation history and reserve funds, often they'll have the selling agent will have to pay a fee to the building management company to get those reports. And they're not going to do that before they get an offer on the table. But the offers are non-committing. So we always note on all the offers that they're pending due diligence. So if we find out that something is just less than savory, we'd still be within our polite manners to say that, look, we have to pull the offer back or reduce the price because we found out that this and this and that. But if we just do that because you got cold feet or you ended up going for a different property and we don't really give them a good reason for why we're pulling back, then that agent will not work with us again. So we would ask, if you work with us, we would ask that we pursue the properties just one at a time, like investigate them one at a time, confirm whether we're going for this one or not before moving on to the next one.
Okay. That is fair. Bob, many good tenants, basically, I think the point is 10 past. Okay, so you talked a little bit about the sort of, so I buy a place, obviously, I receive the yield and then I think you talked about this before. So how much would I put aside for sort of dealing with ongoing sort of costs and that potential, you know, like say if the tenant moves out and I have to renovate or boiler goes or other sort of, what's the sort of standard?
Statistically, I would probably, and look, it's an average, right? Like you could have 5 years of nothing happening and then suddenly be hit with a big one, or you could have a tenant move out 3 months after purchase. So any number I'm going to give you now is just statistical averages. And obviously with a single property held over a short period of time, they tend to be a lot more skewed. Like if you had a portfolio of 20, 30 units over 10 years, I'd say the average is about 10% of the gross rental income to put aside. Right. Of the net income, sorry, to put aside. But again, that's just a statistical average. So you do want to have some cash reserves from the get-go, I would say. Yeah.
That's saving. Suddenly buy one, and then the average renovation, because isn't it about a million or something, the average renovation, or is that more larger?
No, bathroom, if you have to replace an entire bathroom, that's somewhere between 800,000 to 1.2 million.
Right.
If you have to replace an entire kitchen, that's maybe another half million or so. Again, we're talking about studio one bedroom units, yeah? But the average for renovations, like let's say a tenant moves out, the average for a renovation I would usually is going to be somewhere between 60 to 80,000 yen per year of tenancy.
Okay. So that would, what kind of, so for that 5 million, what would it be? Just one LDK or just the one room and a kitchen kind of thing? Is that what it'd be?
Yeah. 1R or 1K, or if we're lucky, 1DK maybe.
Okay. So just a kitchen, a toilet. Kitchen
plus dining maybe would be the biggest, and an actual room. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Usually it's going to be a studio or studio with a separate kitchen.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay. And then, so the long term, so you buy a place. So what's, and if you stick to sort of 1990 or something, what's the sort of the long-term value of the asset? You predict that it sort of depreciates over time, the value? And
it depends on location. The only thing that can retain or gain in value in Japan is location. It's not going to be the structure itself. The structure pretty much depreciates. Loses value as the years go by, but the location might become attractive. So Fukuoka City, for example, if you bought central in Fukuoka City 10 years ago, regardless of how much the building depreciates, you might be double figures right at the moment. Same obviously goes for central Tokyo, central Osaka. Other locations, it really depends on what happens in the location. So areas can become a bit more popular, a bit less popular. There might be new construction in the area, which pushes down prices for existing older buildings. Just market fundamentals, it's hard to say in advance. I would say that investment properties are usually priced by the rental income that they can generate. So for example, if you're looking at those one bedroom units, it's very unlikely that they're going to be purchased by an owner occupier. They wouldn't want to live in there, right? And the people who do live in them would never be able to afford to buy them. So you're most likely buying something that's classified strictly as an investment property, and those are priced by the rental income that they can generate. So as long as building fees didn't go up too much, and as long as the rent hasn't dropped too much, you'll probably be going to sell at the same price or higher if the area is successful. But if rent has dropped significantly, building fees have increased significantly, that means the yield has also shrunk, in which case the price will be reduced as well.
How do you manage that? So what's
I can give you a ballpark figure from our experience with clients who have sold properties. Most of them are buy and hold, so we don't really do that much. We had a bit of a wave of sales when that new legislation notification came in. So most of them have sold at either the same price or maybe up to 15% less. Some of them in more central popular areas have sold it up to 15-20% more. But I'd say on average, usually people sell at around the same price that they've purchased. But I mean, even if you're selling at 10, 15, even 20% less, but you've had, you know, 6-7 years of 5% or 6% or 7% rental income, and then you're already well in the green. So that's not really a huge concern usually.
Okay. And then, so if you buy and hold, the sort of outcome is the building's going to fall down, or what's the, I mean, you obviously can't hold forever.
We haven't had too many cases where that's happened. We always either, I mean, look, one of two things will happen. Either the yield will start shrinking because building fees will start going up, at which point you'll probably want to sell so that you can put your money in something a bit more attractive. Or, you know, properties that have been yielding high returns and have been getting very old for a long period of time, but the owners didn't really have an incentive to sell because the property was still yielding good returns. In those cases, we had developers just come in and start making offers, pushing towards a sale. And at some point or another, they get the 80% that they need. And that, you know, it's just, we don't have much of a choice, we sell. We haven't had buildings that have been declared unsafe or due for demolishment or anything of that sort yet. But we try not to hold, on behalf of our customers, we recommend that they sell when the building is approaching 40 years old. So that's probably going to be the case in the future as well. I don't think we'll see anything being torn down under us.
Okay, so there is a sort of end point that sort of, you know, you can get out either by selling roughly the price you got.
Yeah, sometimes less, depending on what happens with building fees and rental income. Yeah. But hopefully after enough time and enough rental income has accrued, so you're still going to be profitable.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so it can be sold. Yeah. And then so money in and out of, like, my money's in the UK. So I've kind of tried to research what's the easiest, most cost-effective way to get money into Japan.
We work with OFX, which are similar to Wise, which were formerly known as TransferWise, if you know them. It's always better to use a foreign exchange provider and not use direct bank transfers because the bank will kill you with the rates. Mm. If you're talking about, you've mentioned that you're transferring over about 300,000, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, depending on the, but potentially around that much. So, yeah.
Well, just to take that as a calculation, if you're transferring $300,000 at bank rates, that means that you're losing at least 2 yen per dollar.
Right.
Compared to a foreign exchange provider, so that's a loss of about $6,000 there, right? So you definitely don't want to use the banks. You want to sign up with a foreign exchange provider. We have been working with, and we recommend OFX. They're very, the rates are similar between all the foreign exchange provider. There might be a yen higher or a yen lower depending on the day. But with OFX, we just feel that we have somebody to speak to. So if, for example, if we booked a deal by mistake, we can contact them and say, look, that was a mistake. Please cancel the deal. And we have an account manager there. We have a person to speak to, and they're always very willing to help. Whereas with the other, TransferWise is the biggest one, or Wise they're called now. But they're fairly automatic. There's no one to speak to. If you cancel a deal, you pay the fee for booking the deal. There's nobody to speak to change anything or to receive a response from if anything's gone wrong. So we would recommend OFX. We're also got a partnership with them because we're a corporate account. So we can give you a link to sign up that'll further improve your rates if you work with them. Other biggest one. I think Compass is one of the other big ones. I haven't worked with them specifically, so I can't really provide an opinion on them.
What would be the rates for OFX?
They're always going to be at least two. Obviously, the rate depends on whatever the exchange rate is at the moment. So the best way to make sure you're not losing money is to monitor the exchange rate. And when you see there's a peak, are you transferring from pounds or from dollars?
From pounds. It peaked at 156. Now it's gone down to 150, I think, because of the COVID outbreak.
They pushed it back. Have a look at what the last, year has done with the exchange rates. That'll give you an idea of when is a profitable peak. And when it reaches that point is when you want to transfer.
Right.
And then OFX will always, Wise or whoever you use, OFX will always be at least 2 or 3 yen better than the rates the bank will give you.
Right.
So if you look at the median rate, like if you just Google, you know, one British pound in Japanese yen, you get the Google median rate. So foreign exchange providers will be somewhere between 0.5 yen to 1 yen off that rate, whereas banks will be 2 or 3 yen off that rate.
Okay, right.
Kind of like when you exchange money at the airport when you're going to a foreign country, right?
What about Is there like any sort of digital online? I was trying to look at other. I know there's a lot of these like Revolut and places like that that sort of do currency exchanges.
No, those are all online. Everything I've mentioned so far is all done online.
Okay, are they? Yeah. Okay, yeah. So there. Okay, so I'll look at that. And
I'll
then
send you a link to OFX, the registration link. So if you do sign up with them, make sure you use that link, and that'll give you access to our corporate account manager and also better rates.
Okay. Are you okay for time? I know we're going on quite a long time.
I've probably got another 15 minutes or so. After that, I will have to go on to another one.
Yeah, got it. Okay, so only last couple of questions. I'm just sort of broader market. So the sort of COVID outbreak and obviously the global sort of financial, you know, asset sort of boom.
Yeah.
How's that affecting Japan real estate, and is it sort of sustainable?
It hasn't affected us significantly. We've seen prices slightly softer in Tokyo, Osaka, Nagoya, but that's sort of stopped now as well. Now that the vaccination rates are up and people are feeling more confident to be walking around again and moving house again and doing business again. Japan's economy is more dependent on stuff like population decline and the debt to GDP ratio. They've got a lot of domestic debt, but it is domestic. Like, they don't owe money to foreign creditors and so forth. But look, as long as the population is shrinking, the workforce is not going to be growing. So that sort of puts a damper on potential growth, I would say. We wouldn't assume any, like, if capital growth does happen in Japan, it's great. It's a bonus, like icing on the cake. I wouldn't assume it's going to happen in any case.
Yeah, yeah. But what about foreign investors sort of coming into the market?
Always coming in. That very popular foreign investment destination. Always has been. It's considered a safe haven.
Okay.
Because of the yen and because of the governance policies here, Japan is considered a very safe place, even if the yield is not very high here. So when crisis hits, investors actually tend to flock towards Japan.
Right. Yeah, I'm still thinking how that might. And then, yeah, I think that was it. Sort of, okay, so long term, yeah. I was trying to sort of pan sort of pre, after, and then a more broader sort of long term kind of perspective on the market. It was just more about COVID. Investors coming in.
Yeah, to summarize what we've discussed about how we can help, I'm not sure. I'll send you an explanation of services document if I haven't sent it to you yet.
Yeah.
Just scrolling down through our emails yet. I don't think I have sent that to you. So I'll send you a explanation of services document just to explain what we can do, how much we charge, and how long everything takes.
Yep.
And then if and when you want to start research, just let me know and we'll kick off the engagement process.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at an apartment today, hopefully at 12 today. So I'm going to go off soon and look at that. And that's the sort of 24. So I've just got to try and see what the issues with that. And then I'll sort of keep looking and sort of keep considering sort of where the sort of price points are of apartments here and then what money that leaves over.
Yep.
I might even sort of continue renting for the foreseeable future. And then, you know, if the, you know, in 2 years, if I'm getting permanent residency, then that gives me access to a lot more finance, which I can.
That's not a bad idea. I would think, I'm not sure how, you know, if the rent that you're paying now is a disaster or not, but if you've already been renting for 8 years, it might be a good idea to just rent for 2 more years so you can get the financing.
That's what, because everything I look at, it's like, you know, it's if I just get a little bit more, you know, 10, 20 million more, then, you know, it just pushes me much into a much newer, better location, yeah. Just a much better asset to have. But it's just obviously, I can't get financing. I'm competing with all the Japanese who can just get, you know, 100% financing like that. You know, they can easily.
I think, look, if I was in your shoes, I'd probably wait the 2 years and just get something better and also less cash out of pocket, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an option. I mean, again, I'm still trying to juggle and see what the what I can, what the market's like and things like that. And I'm seeing it as a learning process, you know, talking to you, trying to understand sort of real estate and obviously, you know, the asset as a, well, one as a home, obviously, for myself and my family, and then another for sort of as an asset for sort of future yeah. wealth. So it's a learning process, and I'm happy to wait and you know, take my time on things. So I appreciate the time that you've given us to talk about things and share your insights.
Anytime. So, always happy to. So I'll send you the explanation of services document, and then if you're looking at potential properties, whether it's for your own home or for investment, don't be shy to just send me an email and ask me my opinion about them. We don't charge for that.
Okay, brilliant. And thanks for all the work you've done sort of on the podcast and the YouTube videos. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad you're enjoying that.
Yeah, no, it's good stuff. So I learn a lot. So thanks, and hopefully you're doing it.
Awesome. Good meeting you.
Okay, cheers. Thanks very much.
So there you have it. As promised at the start, serious deep dive into buying, managing, and selling investment properties here in Japan with a focus on condo units, which are one of the most, if not the most popular asset class here in the land of the rising sun. Hope you found some value in it. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com, and he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.